Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In winter 2015, the National Park Service, NPS, advertised a job listing in search of the next Ansel Adams, 1902 to 1984, the landscape photographer known for his 1940s NPS commission to document nature as exemplified and protected in U.S. national parks. The full-time position with the Heritage Documentation Programs, HDP, required experience with large-format photography, which provides a higher resolution, is more durable than 35mm film, and allows the photographer more control to render perspective. Milwaukee native Jerob J. Ortiz was selected for the position out of 5,000 applicants. In this presentation, held on April 18, 2017, at the National Gallery of Art, Ortiz shares the photographs he has taken while serving in this important role.
Hello, everybody. I'm honored to be here talking here at the National Gallery of Art. To be honest, I can't believe it. I'm usually a much more of a listener than I am a talker, so just bear with me a little bit and we'll get through this together. I'm just going to open by telling you a little bit about myself, where I came from, what I've been through, things that have kind of, you know, shaped my approach to photography from an early age. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. As some of you might be familiar, it's a very post-industrial town. My father was a police officer there. And he always thought it was very important to take me around the city and show me all the areas of the city. And it started when he would take me down to the port of Milwaukee and show me these sights of, you know, boats coming in, going into port, the shipping that would come in and out. He would take me to the old factory areas down through the Menominee River Valley. And I would see these incredible buildings, these incredible factories, and I'd always just in awe as a child seeing these things. I think that was the beginning of me being able to understand what it is that I was looking for when I saw these kinds of structures, the way that they interact with their environments, the way that people interact with them, what importance they have to communities, and then how the characteristics of them change with the lighting that's available at any given time. After I did live there for most of my childhood, but then kind of moved around a little bit. And after graduating from high school, I did a stint in the military with the Air Force, 6 years, which took me to Alaska. I chose to go there. A lot of people said, why do you want to go there? That's crazy. But it was a dream of mine since I was a child to go to Alaska, hike through the mountains and fish the rivers for wild salmon and do that. And this was another big moment that shaped my vision of our natural world. It's hard to even put in words what seeing that kind of landscape does to a person. Just incredible. And to have that at your fingertips every single day and see it. A lot of people go there and see it just in the summertime, but when you're there in the winter, you see it in a completely different scope. And one that not many people will see. Negative 60 degrees, though, I can see why a lot of people will pass on that. But then as my career came to a close with the military, I decided I've had enough. I went there for school and I made my exit and went off to school to become a teacher, a high school teacher. Kind of did that for a year, but realized that the landscape of teaching was changing and I wasn't sure that I was really cut out for that. So I kind of transitioned into a journalism path because I've always liked writing, I like reading, and I like information, giving information to people. But I also realized that landscape was changing. Print journalism was changing in a big way. There wasn't much opportunity. And then at that moment, that's when the economy took a dive in 2008, and there wasn't much opportunity for me in Milwaukee. And kind of at this moment, a lot of things just occurred that shaped and changed my life in a way. My friend came home. He was taking a photography course at the Milwaukee Area Technical College, and he came home. And he says, "Jared, come on over here. I want you to see something." And I don't know why he decided to do this with me, because I never showed even the least bit of interest in photography ever. And he says, "I want you to check this out. Just check out this slide film." And I'm like, "What slide film?" He's like, "It's, you know, you put it in a camera and then you hold this thing up and you press a button, and you know, the way that the light interacts with it, it captures the light and it transposes this image onto this substrate." And I'm like, "Okay." So he gives it to me, and I'm just holding it. I'm not even doing the right thing with it, just holding it. And I'm like, "I can't see anything. What am I supposed to do with this?" He's like, "No, you have to hold it up to the light." So I do, and there it is. I see this image, and it was instantly, I don't know what it was that captured me. I think it was just, here you have this, it's a solid entity, something that's chemicals and particles all interacting, the scientific mechanism that's capturing something that's traveling through space and giving you this moment in time. And it was only a week later that I went out and bought my first camera, and it was a little Olympus OM2 35 millimeter. I bought it because I could get it for $25 on eBay with a lens. I was like, "Yeah, this is great. Okay, let's do this." But it wasn't like I ever thought I was going to do photography as a profession. I never, still very infant, I just thought, like, I have to explore this more. There seems to be a lot of possibilities here. But then at this exact same time, there wasn't much opportunity in Milwaukee, so I decided to move to California to get a job as a radio technician with the state patrol. Unfortunately, as soon as I got to California, they had no money left, and I was out there without a job or any prospects. All I had was this camera and an unemployment check of $90 a week. So all I did was just take $10 every week and set it aside, and I made sure to go out and shoot one roll of film every single week while I was trying to find a job, this and that, and just kind of, I'd walk 3 hours a day and take my camera with me and just shoot film. And then when I would come home at night, I would study photography every single night, reading about the technical aspects, just trying to figure out how this all came together. What's reciprocity? What is the shutter speed? What do apertures do? And then just trying to expose myself to as much photography as possible, just looking at it. And not so much like trying to find who were the greatest and best photographers ever, just any photography. So I would spend hours at night just going through Flickr late at night. I would start at 9 at night and not stop until 3 in the morning, just looking at pictures. It was just the craziest thing. I've never had anything consume me like that in my life. And eventually, I realized California was the land of broken dreams for me. And I decided to drive back to Wisconsin. And once I got back to Wisconsin, I had to do a little soul searching. And I thought to myself, well, I think I'm going to go back to school. And right at this time, too, my brother sat me down and he's like, you gotta check this guy out. You have to see this photography. And he shows me this picture. And I go, wow, well, that is incredible. You can do this with a camera? And he goes, he's like, yeah, he's like, this is Ansel Adams. And I go, oh, well, cool. Who's he? What did he shoot this on? Like what, a 5D Mark II or something? And then he's like, No, man. He's like, this was shot on a view camera. I go, what's a view camera? And he's like, oh my goodness, man, what are you doing? What did you read when you were in California? You said you were reading. And then he explains that this was on film and everything. And it just blew my mind that this was a process, an older process. And to me, it looked better than any digital camera that I could find at that time. So I started to research what I wanted to do for school, and I decided I'm going to do this for photography. I'm going to go to school and learn how to all about the photographic process. But I'd want to go to a school that's going to teach me how to do this in the way that Ansel Adams did. His zone system approach was what was the most important to me. And unfortunately, there weren't many schools, well, maybe fortunately, I don't know. But there weren't very many schools that were teaching it. In fact, only one school in the entire Midwest that I could find that was still teaching zone system photography on a view camera and in the way as a scientific approach, as in doing all the testing, trying different developers, teaching you all these different elements that comprise a single zone system. And that school was Milwaukee Area Technical College, which is funny because that's where my buddy was going to school when he showed me the slide. And I couldn't be happier that I went to that school, because they weren't trying to tell me anything about my artistic approach. All they were trying to tell me was how to hone in the technical skills so I could express myself in the way that I wanted to. Make sure that I had the absolute control over every last element of this process. They were teaching me the basic principles of exposure, how to meter light, how to adjust your development times, how to use lighting, the characteristics of lighting, all scientific approaches, the physics of lighting, when the limitations of different types of film. And then it even, we did a lot of digital photography there too. It wasn't just analog. So it was this really comprehensive, like in-depth scientific approach to photography that just was exactly what I needed. But during my time there, and let me just back up. I did go there with the intention that I wanted to learn how to use this view camera. And I knew that Ansel Adams used this for landscape photography, but in my research going into school, I realized that the view camera was something that was used for architectural photography, which was an area that I really wanted to focus on. But wasn't quite sure how I wanted to focus on it. But then we went into this, we had a class that was just this view camera class. It taught us all the basic movements of a view camera, how all these things work together, what you can and cannot do, and how to like really push the boundaries with this camera. And we were given an assignment at the end of this class, and it was just do one solid project. All you need are five photographs that have a centralized theme. And of course, me being me, and I'm like, oh, well, you know, I got into this because of like looking at Ansel Adams' works. I'm gonna go do these majestic landscapes of California, Highway 1. So I get a camera from school and I go out on this journey out west and hit Highway 1 with this camera. And oh boy, it was just every day, 15 hours out there, just shooting, 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 walking up mountains with this thing, just camera, tripod, film holders, going down bluffs. And I even fell into a patch of poison oak while I was out there photographing. And get back to Milwaukee to develop the film and come to find out that there was a pinhole in the bellows that I rented, and every single photograph that I took was no good. And that was a hard lesson to learn, especially since there was only 2 weeks left, or I think it was 3 weeks left in the semester to get this project done. And I invested all this time and it was gone. And so I sat back and I thought about it and I said, well, what can I do here? I could just give up and say this is never going to happen and go back and just maybe give this a shot again next semester. I messed up. But instead, I thought about it and I said, you know what? I'm going to go do an architectural project. I am going to use this camera for something that I know that it's good for, and I'm going to stay here in Milwaukee. I don't need to go someplace crazy. I can take great photographs here. I just need to focus in on something that I know is great. And there just so happened to be this little plot of land in the city where I lived, Oak Creek, Wisconsin, where there was some old industry that lots of people wanted to photograph, but they couldn't. There was no access to it. But having been from there, I knew that I could get access to this place. And this is the place that I ended up going to, the High Knight Fertilizer Plant Project. This was an amazing area. In fact, Oak Creek was built on this area. This was the main industry. It all thrived off of itself. It was a huge complex where there was this fertilizer plant, which took materials from a glue factory that was right next door, and there was a alloys metal place that was right next door. But this was the only structure that really remained when I decided to go and do this project. And in the course of doing this project, I really began to discover that you will only get better at photography, or anything in life for that matter, if you push yourself to be better. Here I was, like, in this position where I thought this was never going to happen. I was not going to complete this and I was going to be a failure. And instead I put in a few extra hours every single day, hiked into this place every single day up the bluffs of Lake Michigan to get good photographs. And quite frankly, my instructor couldn't even believe it. I got it done. He looked at me and said, boy, I thought for sure you were washing out of this thing. And he said this was probably one of the best projects he's ever seen come in for his first tier class. And after that, they started teaching me how to implement a zone system. At this point, this was just basic stuff. We're talking very basic, like here's a meter. You just hold it up to the light, you know, you press it and you get a reading and you put that reading in there. I started experimenting with filters and doing those kinds of adjustments and reciprocity failure and all these things. But it was very basic at this point. It wasn't until the next level of school where they started teaching me how to implement the zone system, shooting tons of sheets of film, gray cards. That's all we did for half a semester was shoot gray cards and gray scales and then sit by a little machine and measure the amount of silver that's in each negative based on how long you developed it and then plotting graphs. It was just amazing. I never knew that it was that intense. But there was also something else that they planted in this bit of information, and it was something, you know, pre-visualization of an image. Being able to go to a scene, look at it, and determine, this is what the camera can capture. I know what information it can capture, but this is how I can reposition values inside of a print or inside of a file or anything to make it look the way that I want it to look, to give it my own style. And for those that are not familiar, the zone system as it is an 11-step process. It's just a tonal scale from zone zero, which is pure black, to zone 10, which is pure white. And in this process, what you're trying to do is get the information into this scale of this gray scale, and then work with those values. And when you do it right, you can actually move these things up and down. You can move something from pure like black with detail up to maybe even a zone 5 if you do it right. You can move something that's from like a zone 6 down a little bit darker. And what this does is it begins to give you freedom to really move or influence the way that people look at your images. You get to pick what the main focus of a photograph is. And I began to understand this more as I moved into the next phase of doing documentation photographs in Gary, Indiana. And here was where I began to realize, like, put myself into situations where there were really, really deep blacks and really, really bright whites, really pushing the boundaries of what I thought I could do. Not utilizing electronic flash yet at this point, just doing it off of natural light. And at this point too, I started becoming more comfortable with the zone system. Not quite there yet, but comfortable enough that composition started becoming more complex for me. Figuring out how to place details, like working with different numbers and stuff like that, like to really make the compositions more interesting. And as I started doing this project, I also started to feel something else too with this, like the importance and the urgency of doing this kind of photography. Because as I was making these images, I would go one time, do a photograph, and I would take it back and develop it, and I'd be like, oh, I messed up. And then I would go back to Gary, and I would say, I know exactly how I want to do it this next time. And when I would get there, that building wouldn't be there anymore. It would be gone. Or the wall that I photographed, or windows or anything, those would not be there. They were completely destroyed. So it really made me realize that when you do this stuff, you have to do it right the first time. And I actually ended up working on this project, documenting Gary, for 5 years with my brother. And this is just a very small portion of this project. It really set the stage for everything that I did going forward. It made me realize my love for architecture and my love for photographing it. And it really started pushing me away from the idea that I was going to do landscape photography. But then there was this next area in Milwaukee here where I really began to understand what my instructors were telling me when they said the zone system is not exact. It's not what your meter reads to you. You can manipulate it at the point of exposure to do things later. And that's exactly what this photo represents. And it's, you know, I mean, the photo, it's nice and everything. It's there. The composition's nice. It's not the most exciting, but to me, it is something that I hold dear, because this was the photo where I lined it up and it snapped in my mind, like, I get what they're saying. Because when I metered this, that right there in that area metered as a black with detail, all this in here. And I could have just went with it and said, okay, that's what my meter gives me. We're going to peg it there and that's going to be that. And this right here metered as the white with detail, and I could have just pegged it there at that and said, we're good. But instead I realized, oh my goodness, we can make things up and bring the information in to the in a little bit more towards the middle of the tolerance of the film, and then move those values back into a position that I deem appropriate later. But it allows me to keep this intricate detail in these whites without losing it. And it allowed me to show more detail in these signs, in these windows here and even up on top here. And it was just a total, I don't even know how to explain it. It was a revelation, something that completely influenced everything that I did. And really, I felt it was a major launching point to the next stage of my photography. But there was something that was also happening shortly hereafter that I began to realize that I was becoming too comfortable with black and white photography, far too comfortable. It seemed like things were just coming too easy. Like I could do anything with this. The latitude of black and white film is very large in comparison to transparency film. You get lots of stops with the way that you manipulate development and stuff. So you can get a wide range of light onto this. And I started feeling like I was getting a little bit bored with it. That might sound funny, but it's just. So I started shooting a little bit more with color transparency film, and I was shooting on large format color transparency film to this point, but I decided I wanted to basically just focus on it for a good long while because it was so difficult to get a good photograph with it because of the limitations that it presented. And I kept going back to these two photographs that I made here just before those ones, implementing zone system practices with color transparency film. And I started thinking, I'm going to do this for a while. I want to shoot landscapes with color transparency film. I want to see how far I can push my boundaries yet again. What can I learn from this, from these experiences? And it was really a practice in lighting. Although I wasn't adding any light, but you really get a feel for different kinds of lighting and what is good lighting and the way that it shifts and transitions in such a short period of time. I mean, you see something like this photo right here. I drive up, I see it happening as I'm driving up into this area. And I can just feel my heart racing. I'm like, I know I don't have much time with this. I know I don't have much time with this. The wind is blowing. And now I'm shooting transparency film. Everything is so immediate. It's like so constrained. You need to figure out all these small little details like what's the black? What's the bright? How do I manipulate certain areas of these photographs to utilizing certain filters, which gradient filter is going to come over the top here that's going to allow me to get this detail in the sun without blowing out any of this detail in the clouds. All these kinds of things just start happening so fast, and you have to solve these problems real quick. And I just really, really enjoyed that aspect of shooting transparency film. And it reinvigorated my love for landscape photography. And it launched me into this next huge phase of photography, doing projects in the Porcupine Mountains, State Wilderness Park in Michigan. And I think here, this is a little bit crazy, this project, because I started to introduce outside issues with doing this kind of photography. So now not only am I lugging around all this large format gear and taking this kind of approach, but I'm deciding to take it like 12 miles into the wilderness where nobody goes, where you cannot take motorized vehicles. There's all these external forces. It was always about pushing the boundaries even further. Trying to figure out where I'm going to get my water from when I'm out here, where I'm going to get my food from. But then at the end of the day, it always came back down to the same thing. Like all I ever cared about was the imagery, making more imagery, making stronger imagery, documenting the space around here. And at these particular times for this photo and this photo, I felt especially compelled to make The imagery, because this was during the drought year of 2012, and the Great Lakes were at a historic low. I was really worried about this region at that point. It just was desperate times up there. But it also gave way to views of this area that I haven't seen since. Since these photos have been taken, they've gotten plenty of rain and the lakes have filled back up, but you just cannot even see these kinds of views anymore. I spent a good number of years up here doing this project as well. But it's all worth it when you get to take images like this and you go out, and it's just a real cerebral experience. I spend a lot of time here by myself. I typically go by myself. Sometimes my brother would go with me, but to be able to experience nature like this, you notice and experience things that you wouldn't think otherwise. Your interaction with animals becomes something, I don't know, it's almost religious, I would say. The way that birds will just come and sit right next to me on a log. Deer will literally just walk right up within 10 feet of me. Because you just, in my personal experience, I just feel at ease with the situation that's at hand, and I just feel in tune with it. And you're just waiting for the area to give you what it wants to give you. Now, believe it or not, when this photo was taken, this was almost dark out. This was almost completely dark, but because of the even lighting and the practice of proper exposure, it allowed me to capture all the color. And it almost looks like it would be an HDR image or something like that. But no, this was shot in color transparency film. And the key thing that happened here with this photograph that I thought was really interesting was that I waited and waited and waited, and right as I started to get impatient, a little burst of orange light came right through the trees and hit this log and illuminated the shadow area right underneath here for me and evened it out even more, just so I could pick up that little bit of detail in these areas here. And it's just amazing what happens in these situations. And that's something that I will say to everybody is like, don't be in a hurry to get it done. I know that everybody wants to take photos and move to the next one, but sometimes it is about spending time in an area. It is about seeing what it's willing to give you and just being patient with the situation at hand. And typically with natural areas, I'll tell you this right now, the worse the weather, the better the photographic opportunities are going to be down the stretch. Because this too was taken during the drought, and I mean, oh boy, was it hot. It was hot, hot, hot every single last second of the day. But I mean, bad weather, I have never seen these falls exposed this way since. The way that you get this ribbon effect because of the low water, the moss coming out of there. I don't know. And in fact, the whole time I was here during this time, I only saw two other people the entire time I was out on the trail. So, yeah, the worse the weather, get out there and do it and just be patient with it. It'll break. Sorry. At this point, though, when I was doing these photos in the Porcupine Mountains, I began to really start to develop a method for composition that was, I don't know, it's whenever I try to explain this to my photography friends, they look at me like I'm crazy. And I get it because I think it's crazy too. While shooting out on the bluffs overlooking one of the valleys, it hit me like a ton of bricks. It was like all of a sudden it was like I could just pre-visualize a dot matrix pattern over the entire scene that I'm looking at. And it was like I could just see this. And it what I could do was just like visualize this thing and then start lining up elements of the photograph that I thought were key into stronger areas of the composition. And then it was like I could draw imaginary lines and create shapes with empty spaces and patterns between these points. And it really started to make me think about like, okay, we can move on to the next phase of photography. We got the exposure. We understand the zone system. We understand all these other technical things, how to capture or what kind of light we want. Now it's time to start focusing on compositions and making these more complex. And these are the kinds of images now that I have started to make, where, as you can see, it's people will look at this and say, oh yeah, the Statue of Liberty, but it's these repeating patterns, triangles, with space that don't really even matter to the photograph, but they still add something here. You can see them in here everywhere you look. And these repeat, filling empty space and just giving stuff, something for people to look at, even though it's not really relevant, it just keeps you engaged with everything that's going on. In this photo over here, it was this long, it's the National Gallery, or National Cathedral, excuse me. But here we have this cross pattern here, which I thought was amazing when you look at it from here, and it mimics the crosses on top here. Repeating patterns coming through here, and the way that they all line up with and repeat down this line. It's just an amazing thing to me how you can constantly keep refining your vision through this process, continuously keep learning. And I'm sorry, that is a mistake. That is not a Leica. This was shot with a 4x5 camera. This was digital capture. This photograph right here, I mean, this is just something that happened on a whim. I was out here shooting a project for HABS, the Historic American Building Survey, and just happened to catch this out of the corner of my eye, and I lost it. I was running down in the car like, okay, I know I don't have time to set up the camera for this, the view camera, but I know I can get this quick with the digital cameras. But that leads me to the next thing. You know, many of you have probably heard that I've been fortunate enough to be selected as this new photographer for the Historic American Building Survey, the Historic American Engineering Record, and the Historic American Landscape Survey. The Historic American Building Survey is the federal government's oldest preservation program. And to be honest, I couldn't be more honored to be a part of this program and be working with such a great group of individuals. It's been nothing but a welcoming environment since I've gotten there. And to be working on such amazing projects, like some of these. I've done projects at Ellis Island already, done projects at Cape Hatteras, Cape Lookout, done projects at Bloody Dam. I've seen a lot of things I've never thought or dreamed I would ever see, and it's all a result of just constantly pushing the boundaries of what I thought I could do. And I'm glad that the folks there, Rich O'Connor, Catherine Lavoie, Paul Dolinsky, were able to, well, recognize that I was pushing the boundaries and to feel comfortable giving me an opportunity to be a part of this team. I'm really looking forward to doing many projects with them into the future. But I mean, it should be stated that when I was hired for this job, it was not because I was a landscape photographer. It was because of my ability to utilize electronic flash with an implementation of the zone system, shooting architectural photography. That is like basically the main scope of what we do, is preservation work of our nation's monuments and historic structures. I think it's really important. Everything we do is available to the public. You can get it at our website, which is right here. And this is our collection here. I have to say that it is an honor to be mentioned in the same breath as Ansel Adams, but I do understand that I will never ever be Ansel Adams. He was a very unique individual, and that's what made him great, was because he had a vision and he chased his own vision. And that's what I'm trying to do too, is make my own vision, and constantly refining it. And I think that that's something that everybody needs to do, is look for themselves in their own photos, not chase anybody else. That's the best tip that I can give to anybody. Thank you very much. And if there's any questions and answers, or any questions anybody has, I'd be willing to answer them. Sorry about that. Yes.
Jeff, in addition to your still photos, are these programs also utilizing virtual reality capture?
So the architects that are on hand at the program, they're doing 3D renderings using laser scanning capabilities. I myself am not too up to snuff on that. I got like a maybe 2-hour tutorial just a couple weeks ago on what's going on there. But yes, they are doing 3D renderings of the areas that we're documenting. Yes, sir.
Have you always used the large format photography? I know you mentioned you use the digital cameras. Do you use that perhaps now?
We do not use any digital photography in the documentation that we do. It's all large format film. We are working on developing the digital standards. We're hoping to have them done by the end of this year, but it's a process and we'll see how far along we get.
There's something about large format photography, the way you, I know you're very passionate about it. I'm glad that you're continuing the legacy of the HABS HAIR and HALS program. I actually participated in the HABS program in 98-99 with Paul Dolinsky.
Oh, great.
And we did the Georgetown documentation of 20 historical houses. It was actually instigated by Carter Brown when he was at the Commission of Fine Arts. And I remember meeting your predecessor, Jack Boucher,
yes,
towards the end of the project, because he came in, but we were all hand-inking our stuff, you know, like the diamond tip, you know, pens, front elevation plan, garden plan, and at the end, this man comes in with all these boxes. And I was asking, I asked Paul, like, what's this? I mean, I was expecting him just to bring like a digital camera, and then he explained to me, no, that's Jack Houcher, he does our large format photography. And then when I saw the results of it, I said, oh my gosh, you can't capture this with a digital camera. And I know HABS at the time, 98-99, I know Paul Dolinsky's staff was combining CAD drawings, but the student interns were still hand inking. And I'm not sure if they still do that.
We don't do hand inking anymore.
It's all CAD.
And as far like with digital photography now, there are a few new cameras that have come out that are surpassing the resolution of 4x5, at least. Not quite there to 5x7, but it's right on the edge. So things are progressing quickly in the digital world. It's quite wild.
But at least hopefully with the new generation of photographers, they have the background that you have in terms of appreciating lighting and capturing as opposed to just pressing a button. Because now anybody can pick up the camera and say, oh, I'm going to be a photographer. But then you ask them about the f-stop, they go, what's that?
Well, here's the interesting thing, that even with digital photography, the zone system is still very much a thing. I mean, I use it on every single digital image that I capture. Basically, the way that I look at it is the camera is a tool to capture information. It is not the end-all be-all of the photographic process. You just have to figure out what the limitations are of that piece of equipment that you own and figure out how to capture all of the information with it. And then what you do with that information afterwards is the real art of photographic, you know, making photographs. Yes, sir.
Do you develop your own film?
I do develop my own black and white film. That's a major part of the zone system is having that honed in timing. Like that's the whole part of the testing process is figuring out with this meter, this stock of film, and this chemistry, this is what I need to develop in order to get the results that I'm looking for. I don't do my color transparency film because that is such a finicky process. If that the temperature even changes 1 degree, we're talking, oh boy, that's a big mess. Black and white, you might be able to get away with that, but color transparency, no way. So we send that out to a lab. Yes, sir.
I imagine in Milwaukee with your classes that the Calatrava Art Museum Annex was a very popular subject, and I'm just wondering, do you have any special insights into how to capture the different shadows and lights and other things, since that's architecturally such an amazing place?
Okay, so with the Calatrava, this is really hard for me to admit, I've never photographed it. I've never ever photographed it. It's really weird. And a lot of people, you know, just like the same response, you had like, wow, I can't believe that you just said that. And I felt like so many people photographed it. So I would always go to places that people weren't photographing. I spent a lot of time on the north side of Milwaukee photographing, or in the old industrial areas, the ports, or going down to Gary photographing stuff that was immediately in danger of disappearing. That was a relic of our past, something that was a part of our heritage of some sort. I mean, with the Calatrava, I've seen lots of people photograph it. I've been in there many times, and I know how I would photograph it. I would basically be looking for that nice soft light that comes through there at the earliest part of the day, and focus on shapes and just patterns and everything there. It's really hard with perspective correct, because that doesn't really, there's not really too many straight lines in that place. So really I would just focus on leading, like lines that are leading through and how those shapes interact with one another there. Yes, sir.
So how did you get into a lot of these industrial sites that were kind of American? I mean, did you get permission to do this, or would you just kind of, you know, go
ahead? So,
yeah, because a lot of them, you know, obviously were abandoned. They might have been, you know, had no trespassing, you know, stay out.
So, when I started doing this, I did originally try by calling people and saying, like, I just want to do a photographic thing about this. It's nothing. I'm not like trying to sell the images or anything. I just want to do a record of this. It's for a class. And I would never hear anything back from the people that own them. They just would never call me back. So my father, being a police officer, I talked to him about it. And I asked him straight up. I was like, well, here we have a building. There's no locks on the doors. The windows are missing. I don't have to break in to get into it. What's the rule here? And he basically told me, if you don't have to break in to get in, and you don't have spray paint in your bags or anything like that, most police officers are going to give you the okay on it and just say, okay, cool. Which ended up being the case most of the times in multiple cities. I would just walk into the places and just start taking photographs. And in many times, I would just be unloading bags of equipment into these places with the cops sitting right outside of it, and they never said anything. It's different in different areas, but in the Midwest, in the areas that I was going to, they got a lot more pressing issues to worry about than some photographer going and taking pictures of a building.
But a lot of these places most likely were, you know, dangerous to be inside of. I can't remember the photographer's name in Chicago.
Richard Nickel.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, there is definitely that. They were so there was a method to the madness. Okay, so like it wasn't like I would just like go diving into the first abandoned building I saw. Everything was always well researched. Like I would find areas and then I would look up the building, find out what it is about the building that was interesting to me, look at the area around it, and then I would typically go to the building, and before I even took anything out, I would go in and walk around and I would inspect the level, each level of the building from the ground up. So you start in the first one and then I look around, check the walls, how are the integrity of the walls, and look up at the ceiling and check the integrity of that, because if I go up one level, you can see where the floor is going to be bad if you look up at the ceiling of the level, you know, above you. And it would just be a process of going up like that, inspecting staircases, always walking closer to walls where it's sound as opposed to the middle of a hallway, walking close to the edges of stairs as opposed to right up the middle. And it's especially worrisome when you're walking up with 50 pounds of gear on your... So yeah, I mean, it was a process. Definitely seen some buildings. There was one time where I actually saw a building fall down. The old Packard plant in Detroit, it, right in front of my eyes, I saw a whole wing of it just crash down. And yeah, I never went back there. Yes, sir.
Do you have any projects coming up with the national parks,
the landscape? With the landscape survey? The tidal basin. We're working on the tidal basin right now. Right now, based on what I've been photographing, there has all been dealing with the way that the tide is coming up. So far, these are the photographs that I've done. Things are going to be different as I move forward, obviously, showing relationships of paths and everything as they relate to the views, to the monuments and everything like that. But the photographs I've taken thus far have been dealing with the way that the tide is coming up higher and pulling up around the backside of the wall and pulling the dirt down. And actually, you can see the basin wall separating from the side and is pulling it out into the bay or into the pond itself. So we are doing extensive documentation work on this area as we speak. Yes, ma'am.
So what other projects are you working on now?
Right now I'm working at Ellis Island, doing photography there of the powerhouse on the south side of it. It's the side of the island that nobody's allowed to go to. working on photographs of the old power station and doing the administration building there. Also doing some work in Shenandoah, the old maid's cabin. I just developed some of it, but we already went and I went and shot it. Was Cape Lookout Lighthouse on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Trying to think of what else. Right now my schedule's so full that it's like hard for me to remember. I'd have to have my I lean on looking at my schedule a lot.
Are these photographs up on the website?
They're not up there yet. No, the Library of Congress has to scan them and then they will post them right into our collections right there. But they're a few years behind right now. They're working on the Farm Security Administration photographs right now, and then they're going to get back to scanning our collection. Yes, sir.
I know a majority of these projects are basically document structures and buildings in the U.S., basically just keep the record just in case they collapse or they're in the process of being renovated. Have you collaborated abroad with like ICOMOS, with like stuff that's going on in like historic sites abroad, like what's going on in, I don't want to say further, Syria, but stuff that's either being destroyed, are you?
I haven't been a part of any of those discussions. I know that they have done projects in France. I know that there have been projects done. I think there was one done in Afghanistan. Is that correct? To the people that were, Afghanistan. And I know that there was something that came up about doing a preservation detail in Iraq, I think, which I would love to do that, but I know some people would say you're crazy, but I think that's a really important thing, a really important project to take up. So yeah, there are those opportunities. Yes, sir.
So is it a little less thrilling now that you have permission to go?
It's kind of crazy because these are the kind I would say is just as because the places that I'm getting access to now, these are not places that you sneak into. These are, you know, these are really, really exclusive locations. And I mean,
sorry, I just had to ask.
Yeah, it's an honor to be able to do these projects. It really is.
Now, with the downloads from your website, what size files are you able to download?
Oh gosh, I don't know off the top of my head. I know it's a pretty big sized file. I know that you can make some pretty big prints with them. And that's the whole thing. I mean, they're made for that. I know the library uses a camera, a scanner with a digital back on it to do the reproduction of the negatives. So it's a pretty high resolution file. All right, if that's all, then thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.